It's 104.7 The Rocket. That's Barracuda by Heart, one of the great classic rock bands of all time. And Heart, at least in my eyes, they're a band that's had two real careers. They had their initial career where they were more of a hard rock band, and then mid to late 80s, they sort of turned the corner and became more of an AOR pop rock type of a band. But they've really never stopped putting out great music, great material. And on the phone right now, we've got the author of a brand new book, which is called Heart in the Studio. It's a book that actually chronicles basically the evolution of the band from record to record and studio to studio. Jake Brown is on the phone with us. Jake, how you doing?
Great, Chris. I am in Arizona cooking, but I'm very happy that you are a fan of the band as much, it seems, as I am, and that you're really enjoying the legacy that they're now starting to finally be celebrated for. They've reached this milestone, and you were touching on the 70s hard rock aspect, and what really strikes me about the fact that they're still as rotated on you know, be it Jack FM or classic rock, as often as you would hear any new band. You know, they really have a lot of love out there from fans that hasn't gone away, and it hasn't gone away in part because they're the only female hard rock act to ever attain this kind of a status where they've been around 30 plus years. Because Fleetwood Mac had, of course, the pop rock, you know, that you alluded to for the 80s that they fell into, but they really retained their hard rock roots throughout that, and it's a pretty unique status because there's no competitor, there's nobody else. Not even that would be the nature of it, but there's really nobody else that's attained what they have, and it's really a pinnacle that should be celebrated. You know, so this book is an attempt to kind of contribute to that, along with what we hope is a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction nomination next year, and you know, the co-headlining tour with Journey they're doing this summer. There's a lot of things going on for them right now that are amazing, that we're just happy to be a part of celebrating. So.
Well, Jake, the one thing that I've always thought about Heart, and you know, as I told you off air, I am a very big fan of the band. But the thing that I've always found interesting with Heart is the fact that they are, and if you look through the history of rock, all the way from the 50s till now, they are the one and only band, female fronted or female with ladies in the power position in the band, that really never used the you know, the sexual aspect themselves, you know. And I mean, the only other one I can think of even close to that might be like Alanis Morissette, but it's an amazing thing.
It is, and the reason I'm dying to jump in is because I write about this in context of the women's lib movement in the 70s, that they weren't even intending to be as big a part of this. They really were, if you break it down. But when I interviewed quite a few people for this book, you know, aside from just producers like Mike Flicker, who did all of their 70s material, Keith Olsen, you know, Richie Zito, and Ron Nevison, mm-hmm. of course, who was responsible for the majority of their huge hits in the 80s, all of them say the same thing relative to your point, and that is that Ann and Nancy Wilson, more than anything else that they might have objected to, and you mentioned Barracuda, and it's actually the subject of that song is about a promoter that attempted to portray them in a sexuality-oriented, really kind of sleazy light, to sell more tickets, and the label attempted to do that. That was one of the reasons that they had the lawsuit with Mushroom and tried to get out of it. Well, got out of that deal eventually, was the way they were being put out there in the media and put out there as this sort of sexual innuendo. And when I interviewed Sue Ennis for the book, and Sue Ennis, for anyone who's a Heart fan, is not familiar with her, co-wrote Dog and Butterfly and a lot of really, you know, beloved Heart songs that dealt with that issue of feminism and the women's lib movement and what it was about to be a woman in the 70s with all of this, you know, opportunity to actually draw attention to it. But where Ann and Nancy, there was a distinction that they always made that it was not their goal to be put in any way marketed. You know, they wanted it to be about the music, and so they've rejected that all throughout their career. And it's just amazing. It's interesting you brought that up because they never once gave into it. They never said, you know, we want this to be a reason why our fans love our music. It was always about the music, as cliche, you know, as that can sound sometimes.
Sure. And one of the interesting things with that, too, when you really look at the whole picture, when you step back from the songs and really look at what was going on, especially in the 80s, yeah, I mean, obviously, once they hooked up with Mutt Lange, they had their resurgence, you know, after kind of going, I wouldn't say dormant, but disappearing from the popular you know, popular music sect. But the thing that I want to get to here is that they were a very big popular MTV band, but did not fall into any of the MTV trappings of, you know, of really, again, using the sexual thing to keep them on TV.
Yes, and when you know, and that's a very good point, and it's illustrated obviously in a pretty irrefutable way by you know, the video collection, even though there is, you know, a focus on Nancy in some parts, but, you know, it's nothing that's exploitive. And what's interesting too is you mentioned Mutt Lange, which actually came with the All I Want to Do Is Make Love to You era in the early 90s. That came in late, you know, like 89, 90.
Right.
They were making that record, but when Ron Nevison had them in the mid 90s, you know, Ron Nevison is one of the classier acts in pop production, because he really tried to stay true. As much as they had an issue, and they've made a very public point about covering other people's songs, they really had their first generation of fans based off, you know, Ann and Nancy, and sometimes, you know, with Sue writing these themes that, you know, fit the times, and they fit the mold of the culture they came, you know, popular in. But it also was a mark they made that no one else could have made. So when the 80s came around, and they were then in that 10-year mark and having to, you know, really get back on the horse and kind of play, you know, play part of the teen game again, that they really had maybe worried about that. All the producers, everyone I talked to said, even then, they were very, very resilient about saying no, like you're saying. And in the way they were marketed and the way they chose some of the hits they did, it's interesting because it gets into that in the book a little bit, but they always used that mindset in choosing the songs they did and how they decided the trajectory of their career. So,
sure.
You know, it's something they should really be noted for, too, because a lot of bands didn't do that. And they're not respected today in the same way Heart is. And that's really another point of you know, their legacy that's come back, is that, you know, they were just a class act the entire time, and their fans respect that, I think, you know.
Definitely. So. And the thing that, and I'll point this specifically at Anne, I mean, there's no secret that, you know, in the early 90s, you know, she gained quite a bit of weight, and took a lot of heat. You know, especially because it was the MTV generation, she took a lot of heat from that, a lot of probably unnecessary, you know, abuse, and never once really, you know, fought that or was anything but classy about it. She just, you know, ignored it, and at least publicly ignored it, and did not let it change the direction of the music or herself or her public image.
Yeah, and you know what's interesting, when you bring that up within the dichotomy of the group, when you look at her and Nancy, and what's really cool, and it's an interesting way to segue and talk a little bit about that in terms of when they were making their records and those issues were at play with, you know, A&R people trying to dictate who was going to sing a song that might become a big video and, you know, lead to that kind of a possibility of exploitation happening and the cameras being more on Nancy. Nancy, there was never a more steadfast ally to Anne in them saying, that's not going to be a part of why we do this song. And when they even were in the studio together, and this dates back to the 70s, every producer I talked to said the neatest part, for lack of a better word, the coolest part about, you know, the most touching about Anne and Nancy is that they were so together. When one was doing her vocals, the other one was at the control room, at the console. You know, they always checked in with each other for opinions. When These Dreams was recorded, originally intended for Anne to sing, and Ron Nevison decided it would be a really more fitting tune for Nancy's voice, Anne, who had sung the majority of their hits. And I asked this question to any different number of producers. Did it seem like she had an issue with that on any level? They all said absolutely not. She was the most supportive person of that. You know, and there could have been a vanity issue in other bands, you know, over who was going to sing. You know, within Fleetwood Mac, was it going to be Christy McVie or Stevie Nicks that sang the lead? You know, Ann Wilson, who had been the lead singer for so many years, was the first person to jump up and volunteer that Nancy would get that kind of spotlight, because she deserved it. And it's just kind of a neat difference from a lot of other situations where you have this, you know, kind of power struggle that can go on that can affect the kind of thing you're talking about, you know, in terms of, you know, who's going to be objectified or who's going to be put in that light. And you know, it was always for them about supporting each other and trying to not give in to that kind of marketing, angle that might have, you know, made them a less respected group, you know.
Right. Now, another thing too, Jake, and I know you're noticing, I'm purposely not giving away what's in the book because I do think people need to read it, because I mean, it's very, some of the stuff that you go into is very, very in depth to a level that a purist would be stunned to read. You know, some of the stuff specifically about the band Heart versus, you know, the band Heart in the early days, which became Nancy and Ann, which, you know, became Heart. I mean, that whole, the whole dichotomy of how that worked is interesting all by itself. But one of the main things that I don't think that you really addressed it in the book, but I thought of it while reading the book was when Heart made their quote unquote change, when they went from being a, you know, from the Dreamboat Annie Barracuda, you know, Crazy on You type of a rock band to a more pop sensitive, radio friendly, you know,
yeah,
right. When they made that change, I remember thinking, you know, I was 16, 17 years old at the time, and I remember listening to it thinking, this is not the band that I grew up listening to. This is not the band at all. And I hated it, to be honest, at that moment. I just didn't like it. But now, you know, with some years behind it and looking back on it, it fits really well all together. It does not feel like two careers anymore. It just feels like maybe it was a little bit softer, but the songs were deeper, you know, to where they fit with the more rocked up stuff. Do you see that?
Well, I see it, but I see what you're saying. I think that it also, as a catalog, reflects the roller coaster that is being a band that's been around that long. I, just to give you an, let's say, a male example, Rod Stewart having to sing that Hot Legs and If You Want My Body, you know, the disco era, the Kiss, everybody had to acclimate to for that one single, you know, I Was Made for Loving You, everyone's got one, you know. In Heart's case, the original plan was, you know, a very much a test pilot because they had a new record label with Capitol, they had Don Grierson, they had a new producer with Ron Nevison, that all they had this team of people who were helping to try and balance for them personally what we've already talked about, and their really insistence on not overly compromising themselves on any level from their core principles as a group, and then still having to make a record that could act, you know, be part like attractive to that kind of era and know what you're talking about. And so what we try to do in the book, and when you say I don't allude directly to it, it's because what I tried to do was not editorialize that and just let the actual stories behind how it evolves speak for themselves. I think if you read, though, the entirety of the book, you get that sense of what you're talking about. You arrive at a conclusion at the end, and it's what I hoped would happen, to where, you know, you look at the band's overall catalog and legacy, and you accept all of it because it was all really good, nostalgically or musically. Heart had an incredibly tight band. Dennis Carmassi and Howard Leese, you know, just a really Nancy Wilson. I mean, as a band, and we talk about that in the book as well, as a rock band, they always stayed a tight, consistent unit. And that is, and that's interesting as we go into it a little bit when you talk about their change to pop rock. Their underpinnings as a rock trio never wavered. I mean, it's very interesting to listen to Howard Leese talk about it and some of the sensibilities that they tried to avoid, Huey Lewis and some of the stuff that just musically kind of fit that time. They tried to really stay true to their musical roots and how they rocked those songs out as well. You know, because if you consider that some of the songwriters offered them to other people, or they could have gone, you know, Neil Schoen wrote one of the songs you're talking about, These Dreams or Alone, I believe. He had a hand in both, and those were originally given to other artists that turned them down that were more mainstream rock, you know, because they thought that would be a little bit too sappy. And Heart said, we're not going to water it down. So they really did try to hold on to their rock roots, I think, throughout the whole period. I guess that's the point I'm making.
Sure. One thing, too, and this is only because I'm a huge fan of this guy's work, but I know it did work, but I can imagine it might have been, and maybe you know, maybe you don't know, but I'm imagining that the toughest time Heart had in a studio was working with Mutt Lang, because Mutt is very... Yeah, Mutt takes over a band, whether it was Def Leppard or AC/DC or whatever.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't seem like the Heart girls are the kind that are going to let anybody take over their project.
Well, it's interesting that I can tell you, we can give a little bit away.
Okay.
It's a really cool story. Richie Zito actually produced the record you're speaking of, but Mutt Lang might as well have been, because when they were recording All I Want to Do Is Make Love to You, Howard Leese and Richie Zito both told me this story. There was a, like, three-note change that Richie Zito made to the riff that comes in before, you know, during the chorus in that area.
Uh-huh.
That's pretty distinctive. And they sent the session at the end of the day to Mutt Lang to listen to. He called back and he said, you guys have to go back and there's something, there's a mistake in the song. And they said, what's the mistake? And he said, there's this three note thing. And it was, he didn't even occur to him that Mutt Lange would care, but he so precisely had produced the demo. And they both said when they got the demo for that song, it was like a finished, you know, Def Leppard song, and that polish, you know, the demo was, could have been on the radio. So he was very meticulous. That's absolutely correct. The Mutt Lange, that was one of those situations that from the impressions and what Nancy said and the band members, they went along with it because of who, of his stature, and because on that one, because it's one of the only songs on the record he was involved in, but look at the hit it became. So the instinct they concluded in the end was right, you know, to just defer it to him. And that's pretty much been throughout his career. He's pretty amazing. I mean, if you, you know, Shania Twain and on. And it's interesting that Hart gave him the first credibility as a producer of a female pop single that partly made Nashville accept him with Shania Twain.
No, no kidding.
He would have gotten it anyway, but it is interesting, yeah.
Well, if I was in a band, believe me, that's the guy I'd sell my soul to have produce me.
Yeah, I think everybody, I think, you know, I don't know if they sold their soul, but I think that they would take that rationale and not stray too far from it in their own reasoning, you know, for why they so precisely listen to him, because that's why he's listened to, because he gets results like that in Hysteria and so forth, you know. And AC/DC, Jesus, it goes on and on and on.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he's a legacy unto himself. So,
sure. Maybe he's the next book that you write.
Yeah, well, I had not to promote, but I have a book on Rick Rubin coming out next year. It's called Rick Rubin in the Studio, and that's the same publisher as Hart. And that's about as close as I've come to the territory of Mutt Lange, because I consider Rick Rubin probably his next nearest contemporary. And so, anyway, it would be fascinating, you know, because I'm sure that it would be a volume, multi-volume book. It wouldn't just be a one, you know, it would have to be a 500 or 600-page book, probably.
Sure.
So, but, it, you know, he, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Oh, no, go ahead. I'm just listening.
I was just going to say that bringing up Mutt Lange is an interesting point at that. They were 20 years into their career almost at that point, and, you know, that gave them another 2 or 3 years before they decided after Desire Walks On to, you know, kind of take a vacation. And when I say that, I don't mean that Ann and Nancy Wilson ever stopped playing together. And that's really an interesting period, because from, like, the Love Mongers, which was their little side group, through until they got back together, you know, for the Jupiter's Darling record. And, you know, throughout there, when they still would tour, they would always, you know, be a great draw. They would always be, you know, they're at a comfortable level now with 3 and 4,000. You know, if they play the Ryman in Nashville, for instance, Nancy sold that out on her own. So their fan base is intact, but they never, even when they were at the Love Mongers with Sue Ennis, it was like a covers group that Led Zeppelin and some of their other influences that they grew up on, and they were doing it at a time when they were a little bit disenchanted with, you know, the rock scene, and then, you know, classic rock started to kind of reform itself, involving them and other bands, and the resurgence the last 7 or 8 years has been really in real time with rocks coming back to a place where the kind of music that they made was missed and beloved, and fans wanted to hear it, you know. And you're right, at an average Hart concert now, you're more likely to hear a lot of 70s catalog than 80s, you know.
Sure.
So maybe, you know, maybe that's just the times in part speaking with their own preferences for the material they'd rather play, but it seems like it's really nicely in line, you know. It's nice that they don't have to go out and do a bunch of hits that they wouldn't want to play, like a lot of bands have to, you know.
Sure.
So it's a great time for them. I'm just really proud of anything that anybody can be doing, be it a fan that buys this book or buys the new record they're working on, or Ann's solo record, Hope and Glory, which was a phenomenal album. We talk about the making of that record near the end of the book. And it's a really an amazing, and it's a covers record that was devoted to her roots, and Elton John's on it, and a lot of people that, you know, that if you really are a Hart fan who wants to know musically, with Ann singing, what her roots were, that's a record to pick up. But we discuss the making of that as well, and just try to cover everything. Nancy's live record, which was the equivalent in terms of her covers.
Right.
There's also, very quickly, there's a record called, that in the mid-90s came out, there was a live album that John Paul Jones was on, that's an acoustic album that's amazing. It was a promo, and they've released it as a live album since. But,
cool.
You know, they really have covered every gamut. So.
Sure. Do you think now, I mean, it's pretty much, at least in my mind, it's definitely a given that Hart not only deserves, but will make the Hall of Fame, you know, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And yeah, clearly they've had an unbelievable career, you know, not only as women, but just as any kind of an artist. Their career is staggering.
That's a good word.
But even with all of that said, do you think that they've ever gotten the credit they're truly due? Because I don't believe that they ever have. They're never one of those bands that you would put up there and say, oh, one of my top three bands ever. Hart and blah, 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 you know?
Yeah, There was a critic that wrote the liner notes for a box set, like a reissue thing that just came out recently. I forget who the critic was, but you can read it in the box set. But he calls Heart the first female punk rock band. And in some variation of that goes on to talk about how in context of their catalog and where they've been ranked and is that kind of stuff is just invariably done by Rolling Stone, you know, or whoever. They always have showed up, though, on the list. They've showed up in the mid-50s or, you know, somewhere like that, but they've always been acknowledged. And maybe what's interesting about them relative to your question is that they're now at a point with the fan base that really does fit with a generation. You know, there are, you know, probably tens of thousands in the total course of this tour of people who are going to go see them. And if you talk to any, if you read any review of the Journey shows right now, mm-hmm. who I might point out have a tribute singer as their new, you know, vocalist.
Right, sure.
You know, the fans still enjoy it, but every review that I've read, and I've read a lot of them, have so far on the dates have pointed out that the fans that can have Heart and have Ann and Nancy Wilson up there, who were their childhood heroes or whatever point in their life, and probably in a lot of cases have stayed, just it's nothing but love. It's like a, you know, the Blues Brothers, James Brown church scene. You know, everyone's
right.
just doing flips and cartwheels. I mean, everyone is just really in love with the band, still as much now as they were when they were a kid. I mean, it's a touching kind of visual because, even if you're reading about it, because it really does point to the fact that I think they're at the best place they could be right now because they've got such a consolidated, and we're selling this book at shows, by the way. They agreed, the management, in addition to Ann and Nancy authorizing and giving the interviews for the book, the management graciously, along with them, agreed to carry it at the concerts. And so if you really, you know, hear about it here or anywhere, or whatever the case, you know, when you're there, if you're in that moment, of course, we're hoping that leads to some, some book sales, but, you know, the band really can be celebrated in every aspect now, if you want. They have reissues of their whole catalog that have just been put out. They've got this tour they're doing. Speaking of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, they've more than passed, you know, the number of years they need to get in, but there's a buzz in the research, not to give anything away or, you know, put anything out there that isn't, I don't want to have to be quoted on, but there is a buzz that I definitely got from the interviews that I did, that among peers and everybody, there's a feeling they belong, that when that feeling starts to become a sort of voice and then a chorus, there's a feeling that they're going to be in the next couple of years. They're due, like you said.
Sure.
And so, you know, if they're co-headlining a tour with Journey, and drawing just as many fans to the shows. I mean, that's split. If you have an 8,000 or 9,000 seater, 4,000 of those people are there to see Heart. You know, you could, you know, by the numbers. I mean, they really do have a fan base that's just beautifully loyal. And so, anyway, I think that the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame just makes sense after a certain point. You know,
right. Well, Heart, there's no denying that Heart is one of the greatest bands that's ever graced the rock world. And the new book, it's called Heart in the Studio. It's by Jake Brown. And Jake, you've been gracious enough to give us a copy of the book to give away. So if anybody wants to get a copy of this book, we'll take the fifth caller at 580-242-6901. Give us a call right now, and I'll tell you what, Jake, since obviously you're a huge fan of the band, why don't you pick a song for us to end the interview with and maybe tell us a quick story about it?
All right, Chris, let's see. You just played Barracuda. An interesting song for you to put on would be probably Crazy on You, simply because it went through such a long recording process. It was pieced together because that crazy, beautiful intro that Nancy came up with on the acoustic guitar was a standalone piece, and they weren't exactly sure where it was going to go. And then the other parts of the song came out in different jams, and the actual assembly of that song took about 8 months. We talk about that in the book at some length. It's a really cool story, and the technology they were working with, the way they linked up machines. I mean, I don't want to get into the mundane of it, but it's not presented that way. It's a really interesting story. But Crazy on You is definitely one of it, the title is apt. You know, a name in terms of the process, the madness that went into making that song. So I would pick that one.
All right.
For sure.
Well, let's check it out. It is Heart with Crazy on You right here on 104.7 The Rocket.